The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's good to be back with you after a couple of days off at the end of last week, thanks to Richard Palmer and Andrew Locher for subbing in two programs last week, Thursday and Friday. Of course, Richard, following his show on Thursday, he took off for Ireland with the crew, I guess early Friday morning, to be there for the Belfast Pack on Saturday night at 7 p.m. We had 49 people in attendance. We were hoping for about 50, so right around the target line. I think 13 months ago when we had the pack in Belfast, we had 51 people, so right at about the same level. Interestingly enough, I think about two-thirds of the people that were there Saturday night were not there for the first pack back in January of 2019. So we had about 13 or 14, I think, that were there from both, but quite a few new people as well. And as per usual, we'll have a nice montage that you can look forward to hearing toward the end of today's program. So stay tuned for some feedback from trumpet readers up in the north of Ireland, Northern Ireland. And if you're an American, you'll have to get ready to train your hearing so that you can follow the accent that's coming up later on today's show. While we were in Ireland, by the way, last week, my son Jude and also Isaac McDonald, they both competed in the All-Irelands dance competition. Both boys came in fifth, so fifth place in a competition that brought in the very best dancers from all over the world, really. They come from many different nations, and this is sort of a lead-in to the World Championships in 6 or 7 weeks. So the two biggest competitions of the year come in the early spring, middle of spring months, or I guess we're still technically in the winter month period. But All Ireland's is a huge competition, and it's preparatory for the biggest of all at Worlds. The Key of David response, I'll just update you on the program from a week ago. Are you watching world events? That brought in 190 responses in total, so a really strong showing on that program from a week ago. The one this past weekend, brace yourself for change in Europe, or brace for change in Europe, that brought in, so far it brought in 103 responses. I believe we advertised the Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy, and another booklet that we've offered quite a few times before. So some of these earlier programs that we've been doing where we've highlighted some literature that we haven't advertised that often, they've done really well, including that one from a week ago on watching world events. Well, speaking of world events, we certainly try to update our trumpet readers at these PAC appearances on the very latest and what's happening in our world. And what was interesting this time around is that, as I told the people in attendance on Saturday night, if they were there the previous pack 13 months earlier, just think for a moment about all that has happened in the 13 months since the last personal appearance campaign in Belfast. Of course, the biggest news, at least in this part of the world, has been Brexit. But even before that, you have Theresa May. I think this was back in May of last year, where she announced her resignation, or that she was going to be stepping down. And then, of course, that gave way to the elections in December, where Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party won big. And then following that, of course, the Conservatives, or Mr. Johnson, followed through on the Brexit referendum. After 3.5 years, Britain pulled out of the European Union, and as I was telling the people in attendance, at Belfast. This is significant, of course, because of what your Bible prophesies about the 10-nation consortium in Europe and how that Britain was not going to be part of it. Never. It was just not going to, it was not meant to be. Well, it was there in the economic union, as we know, for 47 years. But Mr. Armstrong said it would not work out. He knew this because of what your Bible prophesies. And so even when they did come together in an economic union back in 1973, he said, this is not going to work out. This is not good for Britain. His forecast was ominous potentialities. And then 47 years later, Britain left the European Union. No part of it, this seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And as I was saying on Saturday night, here we are. We're living right in the midst of these dramatic, earth-shaking prophecies. Prophecies that are being fulfilled. And if you have the Trumpet magazine or you're a subscriber to the Trumpet, you are, in that sense, you're in the know. You're getting tomorrow's news today. I told them on Saturday night about the demise of the British royal family and how we were talking about that. Well, especially so in the early part of 2017. You have that section in the New Throne of David book and then the article from the Trumpet of that year, the fall of the British royal family. And these are things I know I've touched on this program in recent weeks. But boy, you put together the all the divorces, and then Harry and Meghan, and of course their announcement even last at the end of last week while we were in Ireland, after the Queen said that you can't use this name for your products and so on, and then basically the spokesperson for Harry and Meghan came out and said, well, we're not going to do that, but just so you know, you don't have the copyright to royal, the word royal. This is the back and forth now, the soap opera for the British royal family. Well, as we said in that New Throne of David book, the new revelation from the early part of 2017, that was a signal of terrible things to come upon Britain, as well as a sharp decline of America and Judah. It was also an indication, my father said, that we would see a rapid decline in Britain's royal family. That was an indication. That book right there, the revelation in that book, the New Throne of David, it's an indication that we're going to see a rapid decline of Britain's royal family. And look at what has happened almost immediately after that book came out. That's pretty incredible when you think about the accuracy of God's prophetic forecast. I mentioned the example of Hong Kong while in Belfast. Again, just in looking back over the past 13 months, going back to the first pack in Belfast and how that the Hong Kong protests, those were off and running, I think, in March of last year. And then we came up to the 70th anniversary of China's communist founding. That was back in August, I believe. And you had the worst day of violence in Hong Kong of the year, the worst day. As all of these protesters, these citizens of Hong Kong, they were taking to the streets because they're losing their freedom. They're protesting the loss of their freedom, their liberty. And here again, the trumpet was warning of this 20, 25 years ago. We had an article, The Hong Kong Handover. That's from 1997, 23 years ago. An article written by the late Ron Fraser. He said, with the end of British rule in Hong Kong, we see a final act performed in the closure of an empire, a God-given empire, and the hastening of the fulfillment of the prophesied curses upon a spoiled and ungrateful nation, the British people. It would appear that the current British generation sees the days of empire as an embarrassment and would welcome the dismantling of that last and final vestige of royal imprint on this nation of covenant people, the removal of the crown from all things British. So we were on this development 23 years ago. not just 2 or 3 years ago. With respect to Hong Kong, Mr. Fraser wrote, "What hope has this old colonial territory in the hands of a government that is still a pariah in the eyes of those who tout for human rights from the free democratic West, it says. This is something last, what happened last year in Hong Kong is something that really did surprise a lot of commentators as they opened their eyes to what was happening and said, well, what's going on? How come it's not working out? Well, what freedoms are being taken away? The Trumpet was saying, look, you're handing this over to this pariah state. You're handing this over, Hong Kong, this jewel, this Seagate. You're handing it over to this communist dictator state. How do you think it's going to work out? It says one has but to contrast the history of China over the past 150 years with that of Hong Kong to make a judgment on the territory's future under Chinese rule. Well, just look at history, Mr. Fraser said. You know how this is going to turn out. Hong Kong's going to lose its freedoms. And sure enough, that's what's happening. The Trumpet told you so. Tomorrow's News Today, back in 1997. And speaking of some of the subjects Mr. Fraser was writing on back then, you look at Sinn Féin's surge in the polls and at elections, and that too was something that was in the forecast at thetrumpet.com back in the mid to late 1980s. Here's Sinn Féin today, the political wing of the IRA. And over the past years, even the terrorist wing has become more active. We even had a terrorist car bombing the second day of our PAC last year. That Sunday, the second day of that 2-day event. And then just months ago, I forget the month of last year, but they targeted this journalist in Londonderry in Northern Ireland. So that's the terrorist wing. But then you have the political wing of the IRA, and that's Sinn Féin. And they're moving more into the mainstream. And what a victory that represents for Europe, for Catholic Europe, for the Catholic Church. And what does it mean for Britain? You've already got this strong movement in Scotland to separate from the UK. Here you have the UK separating from Europe, and then you have Scotland. They want to pull away from the UK. How much longer before Northern Ireland says, you know what, we want our independence as well, or we want to join together with the Republic of Ireland? This is all happening just after Brexit. We're only a few weeks into Brexit. And Sinn Féin, of all groups, of all political parties, it's making these great gains politically. Well, this is from June of 2007, so we go back 13 years on this one, this Trumpet article, where we said that Sinn Féin's aim was to become a legitimate political force in the mainstream, gaining acceptance by established governments, the international community, and the public within their home states, and thus to win power by political means, which they started out to gain by the tactics of terror. Terror triumphant. That was the article from 2007. And the forecast, the Trumpet forecast, was the plain fact is that given a few years, the Protestant majority in Ulster will be overwhelmed by the much more rapidly reproducing Catholic minority. It's simply a matter of time. The Catholic nationalists will simply populate the Ulster Irish out of existence as a province separate from the rest of Ireland. It's only a matter of time, Mr. Fraser said. Look at the demographics. Look at the numbers. And now here today, you have Sinn Féin. It's one of the most powerful political parties in Ireland. It's got quite a lot of power in Northern Ireland as well. Even after the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, this is the agreement that calmed things down, at least in the short run. All these terrorist acts, these atrocities, these murders, these killings. We wrote after that Good Friday Agreement, at its best, it is a most shameful capitulation to the forces of terrorism. At its worst, it contains the sinister seeds of destruction of the very peace that it is touted to produce. Well, the Bible shows that Sinn Féin's rise in power politically, this represents, it's a victory for Europe and the Vatican, for sure. It's disastrous for Britain. And it comes right at a time, as I say, when Britain's trying to make its way as it leaves the European Union. And of course, even as it leaves, you see powerful forces in Europe rushing to fill the vacuum or to accelerate the push for a unified army now that the resistance against it is gone for the most part. And then you have a leaderless Germany, and there's going to be a rush to fill that power void as well. They've got to. They've got all of these competing tyrants rising around the world. Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, these authoritarians, they're in power. They're in place for life. And then Britain's on the way out, and they're going to strengthen their alliance with America, at least with respect to trade. And so European leaders are calling for an empire. They're calling for a strong man. And they'll get one soon enough. That's in the forecast today, if you're reading and following the Trumpet. In America, by the way, some of the news last week, while we were away in Ireland, you have the Trump-Russia collusion rearing its ugly head yet again. This is far from being dead and buried. President Trump last week, or I guess recently, he announced he was firing the DNI, or the Director of National Intelligence, head, McGuire, his name is, and his assistant, Shelby Pearson. She briefed the Senate Intelligence Committee about Russia, and then later she made the mistake of briefing the House Intelligence Committee, because when you do that, you have Adam Schiff and others who are going to be leaking it, the contents of it immediately. And of course, they never really even leak the truth. They always distort it somehow or another, because then they're working in collusion with the media. And of course, once the leak came out, you automatically cue the media frenzy. As the New York Times and others started to report last week that, well, this Pearson gal, she claimed that the intelligence community is showing that Russia's interfering already in 2020. Now, forget about 2016. We're moving on to the next cycle. And Russia's interfering to, you guessed it, help Donald Trump. It's Trump-Russia collusion part two. And then once the media ran with it, here's the echo chamber. Once the media runs with it, then all the Democrats, predictably, they tweet out their responses or they make their official statements. Adam Schiff said, "We count on the intelligence community to inform Congress of any threat of foreign interference in our elections. If reports are true and the president is interfering with that, he is again jeopardizing our efforts to stop foreign meddling, exactly as we warned he would do." So President Trump's the problem. Adam Schiff creates a story. He makes the leak. The New York Times runs with it. And then Schiff tweets out that really the big concern here is President Trump, who's complaining about the leaks and the fact that Adam Schiff's the one that needs to be investigated. John Brennan, former head of the CIA, he said, "We are now in a full-blown national security crisis. By trying to prevent the flow of intelligence to Congress, Trump is abetting a Russia covert operation to keep him in office for Moscow's interests, not America's." This is the former CIA director. Here again, Trump is a Russian spy. He's working with Vladimir Putin. just incredible. Hillary Clinton, the one who lost the 2016 election, the one who paid for Russian disinformation. She said in a tweet, "Putin's puppet is at it again, taking Russian help for herself. He knows he can't win without it, and we can't let it happen." See, she can't let it go. He wouldn't have won in 2016 without Russian help, and he's not going to be able to win in 2020 without Russia intervening or interfering. Well, together with this, in removing McGuire from the DNI head, President Trump has installed the former ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell. He's now acting director, and he's been in there for a few weeks and has been quite busy. I guess he's not even going to be in there permanently, but he's come into office for this short term that he's in there, and he started to clean house, which just has so many from the administrative state, from the deep state, just furious, just enraged. How could he be eliminating some of these top positions, these top officials? Listen to the way Susan Rice, here again, this is another Obama official. This is how she responded to Richard Grenell being put in that post of acting director, clip one.
The tone is not just that Rick Grenell has absolutely no preparation, no background, no knowledge to be the DNI. The problem is that Rick Grenell is one of the most nasty, dishonest people I've ever encountered. I'm not using this language lightly. He is a hack and a shill, and that's all he's ever been. And he has been put in that job for one reason only, which is to turn the intelligence community into a tool for the president's reelection.
That's Susan Rice saying Richard Grenell is massively dishonest. He's a hack, a shill. He's only there to do the president's bidding. Ben Rhodes tweeted, "Grenell is in charge of our intelligence. Through the campaign is a truly terrifying thought." And then Samantha Power, for her part, said, "Appointing as acting director of national intelligence, Richard Grenell, who has politicized every issue he has touched and has contempt for facts, would be a travesty." These Obama people, they're just shocked. They're just shocked that the president could install someone who actually would want to carry out the president's agenda. They simply cannot imagine a world where a president from the opposing party would come in and say, "You know what, I'd like to have Trump people in there." This is from The Federalist. It says, "Grenell has undertaken these efforts unconstrained by political correctness and singularly focused on achieving the administrative's objectives, which he self-evidently shares." He says, "Yeah, I'm here to support the president. He's the commander-in-chief." Naturally then, as with others who have had the temerity to agree with the president they have committed to serve, like Attorney General Barr, since at least the time he used spying to describe the surveillance the Obama administration deployed against candidate Trump, the vitriol to which Grenell will be subjected is great. If you come out and say, "Yes, I'm here to support this president and to uphold the rule of law," you make yourself out to be a target. It says, "In fact, the attacks on Grenell commenced almost immediately after word broke of his appointment. The level of hatred is commensurate with the merit of the pick. It's a feather in Grinnell's cap and only further validates the wisdom of the president's decision." That's a pretty good rule to go by. If the reaction is this venomous, here's Susan Rice right out in public saying he's a hack, he's a shill, he's dishonest. If that's the way they're responding, if that's the way the deep state reacts, then chances are it's a pretty good pick. It's a pretty good pick. He's getting in there and he wants to help the president drain the swamp. When we come back, we'll condense some of the material that we went through on Saturday night in Belfast, material that we've taken, at least some of it, from the new Winston S. Churchill course here at God's College. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit email feedback, you can write us at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
One reason that I wanted to open the pack on Saturday night with just a review of the past 13 months is I wanted to help the trumpet readers to better appreciate just how fast moving events, how fast they're moving today. How we're really seeing prophecies accelerate, and that God is mercifully reaching out to listeners of this program or viewers of the Key of David or readers of the Trumpet magazine. God is mercifully reaching out to warn our people, to warn the Laodiceans, to warn trumpet readers. And I pointed them back to the history leading up to the start of World War II, and just how that there were early warning signs. Years in advance, in fact. World War II really didn't start on September 1st, 1939. That was when the West finally did something. Well, even that over that weekend, they dithered. It took a few days for them to finally marshal enough strength and force to say, okay, we're going to have to fight. Even after, I'm going to get into this in my class later this afternoon, but even after the invasion of Poland, there were still appeasers in Chamberlain's government that thought, well, but what if he pulls his forces out of Poland? Never mind that in the first 48 hours, Hitler had slaughtered, I think, nearly 100,000 Poles, 100,000 people. And still the forces for appeasement were so strong that they thought, some of them, that, well, surely we can work this out. Surely we can make peace. Even as people in Poland were being destroyed. Well, as I say, we've been studying through the life of Sir Winston Churchill this past year at God's College with a new college course, and we've used as our central textbook the series by William Manchester, the first two volumes in particular. The third one's not quite as good as the previous two. He didn't write or have... He died before he could finish that, Mr. Manchester. But we've also referred the students to my father's booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman. Powerful little booklet, which is based in large part on Martin Gilbert's volume, Winston Churchill, The Prophet of Truth. The Prophet of Truth. He was a prophet, says Martin Gilbert. Of course, my father agrees with that assessment. He was a prophet. He was propped up or raised up by the people, as Ezekiel 33 says. And he came on the scene right at the last moment. It was almost too late. But he came on the scene. He was the last line of resistance. Hitler very nearly won World War II in 1940. Well, as I say, Nazi forces, they marched into Poland September 1st, 1939. But before that, there were warning signs all over the places. What about in 1935? What about almost 5 years earlier when Hitler said, you know what? Never mind the Treaty of Versailles. We're going to build an air force. And I'm going to implement conscription for all German youth. I'm building an army. I'm building a massive military power here. And the West, Britain, France, they just stood by. They stepped aside. They said, well, go ahead then. We'll pretend that you're not really doing it. We'll turn a blind eye to it. In fact, we'll disarm, even as you're arming for war. We'll disarm. How about that? Surely that'll make you feel good about us. Surely that'll make you seek peace. Lloyd George, even as Hitler was persecuting his political opponents and burning books and trashing the Treaty of Versailles, Lloyd George, he was the PM during World War I. He praised Hitler as the greatest German leader of the age. Well, he's a great leader. He's a great leader. Said that about Hitler when Hitler was in the early stages of institutionalizing racism. His whole plan was laid out there in Mein Kampf. But here were the leaders of Britain, like dumb dogs, as it says in Isaiah 56, I think it is. They all of these dangers, all of these warning signs, and the watchdogs, they weren't even barking. They were just fast asleep. In 1936, Hitler remilitarizes the Rhineland. Yet another flagrant breach of the Versailles Treaty. He waltzes into the Rhineland and then immediately said in the Reichstag, he immediately makes a speech and he says, we have no territorial claims to make in Europe. Well, this is our territory, the Rhineland, and even though it violates the Treaty of Versailles, all that we're really doing is just putting some forces into our own land, our own territory. We don't have any territorial claims elsewhere. Churchill's response to that was that Hitler's speech was a great comfort for everyone on both sides of the Atlantic who wished to be humbugged. If you wanted to hear lies, if you wanted to be deceived, then Hitler's speech, the same day he marched into the Rhineland, you would have loved that speech. And at the time, Churchill, of course, was quick to point this out, Germany's military strength was no match for France. France alone, but you put France together with Britain, that Nazi machine could have been crushed before it even got off and running. In fact, Hitler, he gave orders to his generals that if France put forward any kind of response or retaliation to the Rhineland incursion, he said to his generals, "You immediately withdraw. You immediately retreat." Sorry. So Hitler went in there. He went in there on the assumption that there would be no response from France or Britain, and he was right. He fooled them. He lied and lied and lied, and the Western leaders of the day, they believed him because they wished to be humbugged. They wanted to be lied to. They wanted to hear peace, peace. But there was no peace. There was war. He was taking steps toward war. That was the first step. Churchill said, "The Rhineland business is but a step, is but a stage, is but an incident in this process. This is the first step toward war." That's what Winston Churchill was saying. But everyone else disagreed with him. No action was taken. Adolf Hitler gained the Rhineland without a shot being fired. Britain and France stood down. They stood down, even when they had far more power. France had the most powerful army in the world. But they stood down in the hope that Hitler was telling the truth. "We have no territorial claims to make in Europe. We're just here to promote peace." Well, what kind of peace involves invading Austria? That happened in March of 1938. And then the media, the treasonous media, they made it seem like Austria just welcomed Nazi forces with open arms. Here again, tens of thousands of people being murdered. And the Western media pretending that everything was great. Couldn't be better. There's parades. What a reception. They love Hitler. Churchill said in response to that invasion, "Why not make a stand while there is still a good company of united, very powerful countries that share our dangers and aspirations? Why not make a stand now when we have superior forces?" This is a point I did dwell on a fair bit on Saturday night. I talked about how our adversary, the devil, he goes about as a roaring lion. He's looking to devour the weak ones, to pick us off. And if we don't stand up to him, if we don't draw near to God and resist against the devil, if we don't do it today, if we put it off until tomorrow or the next week or 2 months from now or a year from now, it's going to be a lot harder. It's going to be more difficult. It's going to be a greater challenge than what it would be today if we just stepped out courageously and acted. Winston Churchill gave another speech, March 24th, 1938. He said, "If we do not stand up to the dictators now, we shall only prepare the day when we shall have to stand up to them under far more adverse conditions. If we don't do it now, it's going to be so much more difficult. The conditions are going to be far more adverse down the road. The problem only gets bigger. If you want to brush the problem away or try to sweep it under the rug, it only increases in size and power." You can see why Churchill would later say that this was a war, a world war that was totally unnecessary. If those Western leaders, those Western nations would have just had the courage, the moral courage to act in 1936, in 1937, in 1938, Churchill was just beside himself. He said in that same speech from March of 1938, "If mortal catastrophe should overtake the British nation and the British Empire, historians 1,000 years hence will still be baffled by the mystery of our affairs. They will never understand how it was that a victorious nation with everything in hand suffered themselves to be brought low and to cast away all that they had gained by measureless sacrifice and absolute victory gone with the wind. Now the victors are the vanquished, and those who threw down their arms in the field and sued for an armistice are striding on to world mastery. Historians are never going to be able to understand why this powerful empire would just lay down its arms and say, here you go, take it over, it's all yours. The same day that Churchill gave that speech, by the way, Lord Beaverbrook's Evening Standard decided to terminate his contract. No more weekly column for Churchill in the Evening Standard. This was a syndicated column, by the way. It was canceled, or he was fired, basically, from about 50 newspapers because of that speech. So here they wanted to blot out the message coming from Winston Churchill. The forces for appeasement were so strong. Beaverbrook said, hey, we don't agree with you. We don't agree with that speech, so you can't write in our newspaper anymore. Well, as world conditions worsened, Neville Chamberlain thought, hey, we've got to pull out Plan Z. We've got to pull out all the stops. He was ignoring Winston Churchill's warnings. He was relinquishing British rights over three important Irish ports. He wouldn't look into air defense. He wanted to disarm. He didn't want to prepare for war. He wanted to go to sleep. Well, he wanted to talk to Hitler as well. He thought, well, if I can just sit down with Hitler, I can talk some sense into him. We can find a peaceful solution here and everything will be solved. So he did that. He cabled Hitler saying that he wanted to meet with the Fuhrer and try to find a peaceful solution to this. So in the middle of September 1938, Chamberlain did that. He met with Hitler in Bavaria. And he came away from that meeting. He told his sister that he thought Hitler could be a man who we could rely upon, and that he was an honest man, that he told the truth. He told his cabinet upon his return, Chamberlain did, the impression left on me was that Herr Hitler meant what he said. My view is that Herr Hitler is telling the truth. You see, these were leaders in Britain who were intoxicated, as the Bible says, intoxicated by the wine of the world, mesmerized by the tyrants of the world. What does it say? These were scholarly men. These were some of the best educated men of the day. Completely deceived, completely humbugged by Adolf Hitler. You think about what God says in 2 Corinthians 11, how the devil comes as an angel of light. The devil works like Hitler did in 1936. He marches into the Rhineland. He militarizes the place. Then he goes right to the microphone within hours and says, look, I don't mean any harm here. We don't have any territorial complaint. We don't have any territorial designs on neighboring nations. And then he just continues to go forward aggressively. Well, Chamberlain thought he could just talk and talk and talk and talk. And all of this culminated, of course, in the surrender at Munich. It was not a peace agreement. It was a total surrender, a capitulation. Stanley Baldwin, he was the prime minister before Chamberlain. I think there were three meetings between Chamberlain and Hitler. The third one, Chamberlain heard about when he was speaking at the House of Commons. He got this slip of paper from an attendant. He opened it, and then immediately he rushed to the microphone and said, listen, everyone, I've got an invitation to meet with Herr Hitler one more time. And the whole house stood up, except for four people. The whole house stood up and cheered and clapped. Churchill was among the four who didn't stand up, and those around him jeered him, saying, "Get up, get up." They were shouting him down. "Get up! You cheer with us! Chamberlain's going to meet with Hitler!" Well, his predecessor, Chamberlain's, he felt like this was an act of God, this meeting in Munich. He said about Hitler's invitation, Stanley Baldwin did, "It was just as though the finger of God had drawn the rainbow once more across the sky and ratified again his covenant with the children of men." That's Stanley Baldwin saying there's not going to be any more floods, no more wars, nothing but peace. So he headed off to Munich. Some few of Churchill's supporters, the anti-appeasers, they got together in London to try to form or draft a statement of some kind saying that they were very much opposed to appeasement. But these anti-appeasers, they couldn't even agree on a common statement. And so they had to go away with no statement signed by this group, by Churchill and some of his anti-appeasers. And of course, Churchill lamented that there's just no courage. There's no moral courage to stand up to this Nazi menace or even those in our own government that just want to give, they just want to give Hitler whatever he asks for. This is how Manchester described those negotiations, if you want to call them that. "Hitler did not negotiate. He simply repeated over and over what he was going to take, when he would take it, and what he might or might not do with it. Nevertheless, the men from Paris and London kept battering away through the evening, and past midnight at 1 a.m., Chamberlain capitulated. Virtually all of the claims Hitler had made in the past were accepted, including many he could never have won by force of arms." He just gave him everything. And then he came back to London with that slip of paper. And you've heard this audio before. This is Neville Chamberlain in London, September 30th, 1938, as he talks about having made peace with Germany. Clip 2.
"This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again."
Tyranny was spreading across Europe rapidly. And Neville Chamberlain and his community of appeasers thought that they could keep that in check, that they could keep the Nazi menace in check with a piece of paper. Less than a year after that statement you just heard, Hitler's forces marched into Poland, and a number of years later, more than 60 million people were slain, some of them in gas chambers, in concentration camps, in extermination camps. Millions, millions and millions and millions of people, millions of casualties. What a catastrophic mistake! But there were warning signs all along the way. Even after Munich, even after the surrender at Munich, Churchill said, "By this time next year, we shall know whether the policy of appeasement has appeased or whether it has only stimulated a more ferocious appetite." That's a prophet of truth for you. That's a prophet of truth. Someone who said, look, we'll know. We'll know who's right by this time next year. And, well, by that time next year, everyone knew. Everyone knew that appeasement had been a spectacular failure. As I tried to get across on Saturday night, we don't want to wait until Poland to finally do something. We want to do it when we see the warnings there at Rhineland, or even before that with the book burnings, with the Luftwaffe, with conscription, then Rhineland, then Austria, then Czechoslovakia. We want to act long before the invasion of Poland. If we wait until then, well, look at what we're going to have to go up against. The urgency of the day, the urgency of this moment couldn't be greater. Now is the time to act on God's truth. When we come back, we'll conclude with the montage from Belfast. I think it goes for about 3 or 4 minutes, and you'll want to stay tuned to hear some feedback from your fellow trumpet readers. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
We conclude today's program with feedback from you listeners, the listeners in particular coming from Northern Ireland and really from some other places as well, as you're about to hear. Here's the montage from Belfast.
I was watching television one weekend. I wasn't going to church that day, and I just flicked through the channels, and this program came on. And normally I would just flick all past. There was a lot of Bible programs on the channels, so this one just grabbed me by just simply saying, find it in your Bible, just read it, you know, and that just sort of caught my attention, and then I did sort of start to watch more and read more and gradually become more interested in the literature and send away for books and just read a lot about it now and study a lot of it. I'm doing actually the Bible course.
Yeah,
I'm on lesson 20 of that. I've just sent it away recently there and I'm really enjoying it.
So you've been watching the Key of David for over a year?
I'd say around a year and a half now, yeah.
And did you say you were at the personal appearance campaign here last year?
I was here last year, yeah.
Okay.
I've been reading for over a year now, and you know, I found it really interesting with the history and all the history with a bit the trumpet and Mr. Armstrong, Herbert W. Armstrong, and I just found it fascinating, you know.
My name is Wout Bas. Come from the Netherlands, of the city Raisen. I'm reading the trumpet. I know it for 6 years, but I.
And this is your first personal appearance campaign?
Yes,
my first. You flew over from the Netherlands.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on the evening?
Ooh, yeah, really a little bit nervous, but it was really nice. So
yeah.
Better than I expected. So.
Oh, good.
yeah.
And how old are you again?
27.
27.
Yeah.
And you just started reading the trumpet on your own?
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. 6 years ago.
6 years ago, and did it a couple of years, didn't read it,
yeah.
So and now 6 to 7 months, I read it again and I needed to read it, so the truth was very important.
So you attended the personal appearance campaign last year, and you've been reading the Trumpet magazine for how long?
Oh, I've been reading the Trumpet magazine for quite a while, maybe coming up in a year. And I was so enthusiastic about what I had been reading with things happening in the world. And then I first of all went to the PAC in London. Thoroughly enjoyed that. I was so taken with the young people. They were just exemplary in every way. They were so well presented, so happy, so helpful. And then I attended here in Belfast again. I was so enthusiastic. I just loved everything. And then I am now attending with the church, and I am just so happy to be here. I just thank God every day that I was brought to the Philadelphian Church of God.
So how long was it after the first Belfast campaign that you started attending?
Not long. Okay. Not long. I was invited
and
to
now
go.
Now you are a staff member at the second Belfast.
Yes, I am. And I was very, very pleased to have been asked, and I'm delighted to be doing the job.
So you're the only member right now
in the north,
Belfast, or
the Northern Ireland. Yes.
You and your son Louis.
Yes, my son Louis.
Louis, want to say hi?
Come on, say hi.
Hello.
Say hi.
One more time.
Hello.
How old are you, Louis?
12.
Do you enjoy football?
Yeah.
Perfect.
And what do you think of the church?
It's good, and they're a friendly bunch of people.